פרשת חיי שרה.
You can break it down clearly by the parshiyot p'tuchot and sfumot, the paragraphs. And we have, well, how many? Four topics. Two short ones summing up the parsha at the end. The parsha opens up with? Let's call it the name of the parsha right now, Chayei Sara. Going on to the next, and that's the main chunk of the parsha, and that is? The Shidduch of Yitzchak, finding a Shidduch for Yitzchak. Let's just call it the Shidduch That's really takes the vast majority of the parsha is that. After the relatively short opening of the story of Chayei Sara. And then the parsha ends off with two short paragraphs, which are? What? Before that, just before he... Well, it's coupled together. The end of Avram's life is coupled together with B'nai Keturah. Other sons, more sons that he gives birth to, which are going to be referred to as B'nai, let's just call it B'nai Keturah. And the Ptira of Avram, we'll put it all into one, it's one paragraph over here, and we have to discuss it. And the Parsha finishes off with the death of Ishmael. Mot, Ishmael. This is Parshat Chayei Sara. So let's go straight into discussion. Before I continue, I'll just apologize, I didn't really prepare a shiur. I was a bad boy. So what we're going to have to do is try to work it out as we go along together. Bezrat Hashem. Okay. What's somewhat surprising about the name of the parsha, Chayei Sara? And I'm asking on two major levels, both in terms of the content of the name, but also in terms of to what extent does it justify being a name of the parsha? You understand that I'm hinting towards something which we've already alluded to in the past. Yes, Derek. You.
Chayei Sara, but she dies like immediately.
Right. To fill in a sharper way, Nachon, Parshat Chayei Sara, but really the Parsha is not describing the life of Sara, the life we're talking about, the actual death of Sara. So it's a little strange that we open up and we give such a name to the Parsha where really we're describing her death. So it opens up room for a lot of food for thought in terms of life-death issues, which clearly revolve around this Parsha. On another level, what will be difficult in terms of justifying Chayei Sara as a name for the Parsha? What?
Even the part that does have to do with her burial isn't very much the Parsha.
What is that?
It's not very much the Parsha.
Rather. It's one opening paragraph where the vast majority of the Parsha really is this. We drew it here as one of four, but really, proportion-wise, this is really the 80% of the Parsha is this, and then we have an opening over here, and then some leftovers. And I said already in the past, it's true regarding the name of a Chumash, it's true regarding the name of the Parsha, it's not to be taken stam. Whatever the origin is, we view it as having meaning that it contains the entirety of the Parsha in that name, as it somehow contains the essence of that Parsha, the underlying theme in the Parsha. So to go and give an entire Parsha, the name Chayei Sara, where at most, besides the issue that Barry brought up, is that just a mere opening and short opening of the Parsha, that's somewhat surprising. In fact, I would even take it further beyond what Sadia said, and that is structurally, Parshiot-wise, in terms of Bereshit, if you were to have to, how would you break down the Parshiot, going in from Parshat Vayera into Parshat Chayei Sara?
This is more...
What?
Putting...
I can't hear something.
So the whole part of Rikva is at the end. So
it's Chayei Sara. I'm not saying, not in terms of changing the order. Let's say leaving the Seder of Torah, which is, again, not necessarily chronological, but leaving the Seder of Torah as it is, but just break down the slice of the Parshas differently. Yes, Josh?
This is more towards the end. Meaning that this is...
What's this?
Chayei Sara
seems to be stemming from Parshat Vayera. You would have maybe suspected to put it at the end of Parshat Vayera. And then start a whole new Parsha with the Shidduch of Yitzchak. And more so, what even content-wise, why do we know to justify the Chayei Sara and its content really draws from the closing paragraph of Parsha Vayera? Yes, Avi?
Because she dies because of the...
Exactly. She could. She dies because Chazal tells her. Rashi brings it that as a result of the Akedah. Give me Midrashim in there. A bunch of parallel Midrashim, I believe, in a few different places. Pirkei Dei Rav Lezer, I'm sure Midrash Medrash as well. Midrash Tanchuma. Different Midrashim that actually talk about the fact that Sara dies as a result of hearing about what the Satan tells her, the supposable death, or the Akedah of Yitzhak, and she hears that. In fact, a very interesting medrash. I don't know if we'll have time to develop the concepts there. Maybe tomorrow, we'll see. But the medrash in Birkei Rabbi Elazar describes that once she hears about what's described as the Akedah of her son, she cries out three truot and three shvarim, or yevavot, just like the shofar, and then parchan ishmatan, she passes away. What is the relation between the shofar blowing and the screaming of Sara over the supposable death of her son? Not so pashut, but in any case, Josh, what do you want to say? So first of all, Josh, saying that there's clearly a deep Rosh Hashanah relationship between Rosh Hashanah and the actual Akedah, and that is, of course, the blowing of the shofar and the reading of the Akedah on Rosh Hashanah is already a very significant connection that has to be looked into. We'll see. We may go into it tomorrow. We may not, but in any case, that's something to be aware of. But back to our point over here, just pashut, like Avi said, Parshat Chayasar is a result and a product of Parshat Vayera, the opening. Why should we have it as the opening for the entire parsha of Chayasar? So let's leave these questions open for now. Let's continue into the actual content of, which is really going to be the topic of today's shir. We're going to be focusing over here on the opening paragraph. How would you, if you have to title it better now, instead of just giving it the name of the parsha, what is really the content, putting it in one term or two, three words, one sentence, what is really going on in the opening paragraph of the parsha? What?
The burial.
Okay, or? What else? How would you formulate what's really taking place? Okay. It's true the burial is taking place. However, I would like to look for one topic. I would try to emphasize something else, which the burial is a result of. Yes, not
The formation of the next generation.
How's that?
Well, you see, the beginning, Yitzchak is already finding a shit.
No. I'm isolating this. We're only talking about this right now. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. For today's shir, we're dropping all the other inyanim and the questions that we had before. I'm focusing and zooming in totally into the opening paragraph, Parashat Chayesara, Perikaf Gimel, only from Pasuk Aleph to Pasuk Kaf. And I would say, what's the title? Yaakov said it's the burial of Sarah. Yeah, nachon, formulated maybe a bit differently. Josh? The purchase of Ma'arat HaNach Bela. I'm not sure that it would justify giving a title based on quantity and not in quality, but definitely quantity-wise, the main thrust over here is the process of and insisting on the actual acquisition, the kniya, the kinyan of Ma'arat HaNach Bela, which as a result of all that, Sarah could be buried. Okay? But quantity-wise, at least, it's this negotiation, this masal matan, ultimately the results of the kinyan, with the acquisition of Ma'arat HaNach Bela. Okay, so let's try to understand a little more what's going on. Why is Avraham Avinu insisting on acquiring and buying Ma'arat HaNach Bela? Where Ephron is trying to insist and say, oh, you don't have to buy it from us, just take it. I'm giving it to you as a present. Interestingly enough, I'm just thinking about this right now, taking presents is not the most positive thing, and that is, we know from Mishlei, somehow now we're buying a burial place, the first burial and described really in the Torah, and we're insisting somehow Dafka not to take it as a matana. Why not take it as a matana? Why not insisting on buying it? Yes, Benjamin.
The land was very important, and Avram wanted to make it more officially his. So, but if you're money on it, you want to continue on it, and the kind of assist, but just saying someone gave it to me, and it's up in the air whether it's really his or not.
Okay, so Benji's claiming in order to make sure that Baalut, ownership, and Kinyan over Ma'arat HaNach Bela, that's why you're buying it from Pashut, you're right. The only problem with that is, of course, and that is that when it comes to the rest of Eretz Yisrael, we don't buy it with money. How do we acquire as the avot, or ultimately Klal Yisrael, Bnei Yisrael, later on in history, how do we actually get ownership over Eretz Yisrael?
War,
kibush, Yerusha, kibush. But there's discussion afterwards in terms of whether Eretz Yisrael was supposed to really have to be conquered through war or not through war. But all of Eretz Yisrael is not acquired. We don't see any chisaron, and we never are presented with any chisaron with our ownership of Eretz Yisrael because of the fact that we didn't actually buy it with money. So why dafka thing? So why dafka when it comes to Chevron, we have to go and buy it with money? If what Benji has said is correct, and on some level it must be correct, so then they have to be regarding all of Eretz Yisrael. We should go piece after piece after piece and buy it out. Similar to what we're just looking at, looking straight into the so-called Arab quarter. That's what the Jews, some of the good Jews, are trying to do. Near David as well. House after house after house, buying it slowly, nobody really knowing about it behind the scene. But now then it erupts into the news. But somebody comes there to show them, we conquer. There's no chisaron in the ownership, and yet Chevron has to be actually bought with money. Okay, lo pashut. Assuming what Benji is saying is correct, why dafka Chevron? Not the rest. Why Marat Machpelah? Why for burial place? Yes, Sadi.
Is there a fact that Chevron is supposedly the worst land in
Eretz Yisrael? Rashi brings it down, and there is Chevron is considered the worst of the land of Eretz Yisrael. It's Machshim, it's a land of stone and rock. You know, it's not really agricultural. But I don't know if I hear a svar necessarily that they based on that dafka you have to buy it.
So worried about the worst land in Israel, he's willing to make sure to buy it, he's going to give it as a gift, you know, Chalchomer would be worried.
Chalchomer remains as an abstract because we don't really apply it, because regarding the rest of the Israel, we don't really buy it.
Yeah, but I mean, it shows that he's worried even about the worst land in Israel. So.
If that were to lead to the buying of all Eretz Yisrael, you would say, why does it start there? Possibly hear what you're saying. But if it results in the end of someone, we're not concerned about the fact that the rest of Eretz Yisrael is not bought with money. So I mean, there's something over here that's...
Yes. During time, if the rest of the land, maybe change hands, like the different nations, everyone would know that that land was specifically bought,
right,
and isn't land to be toyed with, as in
what?
I don't know. I'm confusing myself.
What was that?
It's not land to be toyed with, as in we bought it. You did in front of all the people there as well, didn't he?
What,
Ma'arat
HaMachpelah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So right. He made it a public statement that.
Except granted, absolutely, you're right. And it continues what Benji said. We're asking, so if that's the case, and if it's necessary, it should be necessary regarding all of them. You're strengthening the question. Yes, Sabi.
Is it also anything to do with Mashiach?
How is that?
Because Mashiach is in the country of Hebron.
It doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
I know.
I'm not familiar with it. Yeah.
I don't know. I was trying to find a connection. I couldn't really find one.
So the truth of the matter is, yes, Barry.
Could you say maybe that's something to do with Avram's mind state, like it says
Avram's what?
His mind state.
Yeah.
It's like, Avram is posed this around with Kosar. So he's coming to mourn and to cry, he's on the mood to fight out, or the other option would be content, I guess, right? Is he gonna do that with his state?
I think it has to be much more. I think it has to be much more intrinsic, essentially. And I would say even more so. And we should learn from that also. The ability, if anything, is so impressive over here, is his ability to handle things in such a thought-out, salut state of mind. On the one hand, completely being sofed and boche and lost his person he shared his entire incredible life with. At the same time, he's able to completely keep a clear mind with not being overly wrapped up emotionally. It doesn't contradict how much, how painful it is. It's not totally not connected with already mentioning, so it's an association which I'll mention to you. As somebody who I'm related to who works in the Zaka, you know what Zaka is?
Mm-hmm.
Zaka is the organization that's the Avodat HaKodesh Chesed Shelemet. It's collecting pieces of the bodies after terrorist attacks and bringing them to burial. Anyways, he's already a few years on that. He's also in the Rebbe Limited State, taking care of Halalei Tzahal. But in any case, he, I don't know if you know, but the Rav Neven Sal Shita is the posik, or one of the posik, or maybe the posik of Zaka. So a few years ago, in the most terrible terrorist attack, and the number two bus that actually left the Kotel, and a few minutes afterwards blew up a little outside of the walls of Yerushalayim, of the old city, this relative of mine came there as a Zaka person and dashed onto the bus and started a terrible, terrible work. And children over there also, and they were on the bus. Anyways, there were some very, very, very heavy halachic questions that came up as they were going and doing the work. And he said at some point, Rabbi himself gets onto the bus. And this person sees him and runs over him and says, this, he has questions that I don't know what to do. So he said, Rabbi himself was supposed to stop and said, relax, first of all, put your tzitzis in. And then, hold on. That's it. You're not allowed to have your tzitzis out in close proximity to the dead. Whether it's in a levaya or whether it's in a somebody in a beta kvarot, first of all, and then, so he brought it as an example to keep a complete clear state of mind in terms of what has to be done, what's necessary, complete da'at, a complete objective perspective. The fact that the scene is completely out of, can't even imagine relating to it on an emotional level, that's a whole other level. Right now, that's not what. Go and mourn and be in pain afterwards. Now there's a job that has to be done. A small anecdote that brings out so much. Somebody else told, I know the same person told me that back in 1973, the terrible Yom Kippur War on Simchas Torah, which is the war was still going on, and this is in Sinai, and the war was still in a very terrible state of it, and there were hundreds of soldiers being brought to the place where all the bodies were brought to, that the Rebbe Nevin State was in charge of, the military Rebbe was in charge of, and Rebbe Nevin was there as well, and they couldn't find Rebbe Nevin all day, they didn't see him in Davening, Simchas Torah, they didn't see him at lunch, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, all of a sudden somebody finds him that he's in Shomer on the bodies. So they told him, like, why didn't you tell anybody? There's a lot of people over here, all the staff, and somebody could have swapped you for lunch for Davening for a couple. Now that avoda is shmira on the met, as halachically we're supposed to. There's nothing else. Nothing else is going on. Just that. Anyways, back to our discussion. So I was starting to say the truth of the matter is Hebron is not the only place to be in Eretz Yisrael to be acquired with money. In fact, there are other places. What other places? Does anybody know? Can anybody think? Scan through your memory or knowledge of Tanakh. Harabait is one, and we'll touch upon it in a second. Which one else? That's much later on in history. We'll touch upon it in a second. Yeah. Shechem.
Right.
Shechem. Shechem. Yerushalayim and Hebron. All three cities are described in Tanakh as being acquired. We'll go through them in a second. But the Medrash actually says it explicitly. Listen carefully to the following Medrash. There are three cities in Eretz Yisrael that had to be bought, while the rest of Eretz Yisrael not, so that if the Goyim throughout the ages come and claim for ownership over Shechem or Yerushalayim or Hebron, we can take out the shtar and claim, like Benji said before, we actually bought it. Okay, so that means there is something about these three cities that doesn't still answer our questions, content-wise, but puts them in a little structure, in a little certain framework. There's something about these three cities that have the potential, that are prone to the demand of the non-Jews and fighting over it, and therefore they need to be acquired, as opposed to, as a result of the rest of their Yes, Avi?
I mean, could it be that their Avraham had vision.
Just before, one second, as you're thinking in that direction, I just want to say, interestingly enough, just check things today, you see really that these are the three center cities and in Eretz Yisrael, which our confrontation with B'nai Yishmael is really revolving around. These three. Avi, what do you want to say?
I mean, could it be that Avram has some insight in the future where he goes out of his way to purchase Hebron. I mean, he could have received that as a gift, which would have been a general gift to Avraham and his children and so on and so forth, which could maybe include Yishmael, even though he sent off Yishmael already.
Yeah, yeah.
But since he paid for it, he already paid off Yishmael, so to speak. He sent Yishmael away with money and cattle and so on and so forth.
Not yet, but we'll get to that at the end of the parsha.
Not yet.
And the end of the parsha is described. Yeah.
My bad. So never mind, that was totally...
Yeah. No, not necessarily, because again, it's not necessarily. Yeah.
So therefore, if that happened earlier, then here, since he already kind of severed himself from Yishmael, now he's using his money for his other inheritance, which is now Yitzhak, and therefore it will be like kind of like another separation where now this is going to hit this this line of offspring.
If I'm, tell me if I'm rephrasing you correctly, what I was bringing up is that emphasizing that the acquisition of Maratha Machpelah is not just for Avram himself. We know historically, in fact, that that's not the case. It ends up being the burial place, the Beit HaKvarot for the building blocks of Klal Yisrael, and the Ir HaAvot, as we call it. And that can take place only after and somehow a result of selecting away Yishmael from the household. You said I accept that. That's definitely something you maybe should maybe develop more and then try to polish it and sharpen the definitions. But again, these three cities in relationship to the rest of Eretz Yisrael. Before we continue, just to describe the other acquisitions, the other acts of purchase of Yerushalayim and Shechem. Yerushalayim as... Yaakov? As Yaakov mentioned, Yerushalayim was acquired. Yerushalayim was acquired, or Har HaBayit was acquired by David HaMelech. This is one of the most incredible episodes described in Tanakh. I'll take 2 minutes and I'll just describe it for those of you who are not familiar. The very end of Sefer Shmuel Bet. The closing episode of Sefer Shmuel Bet, really the book of the life of David HaMelech and his kingdom. We're talking about the wrapping up of his life. As we go from Sefer Shmuel Bet into Sefer Melachim, we're ready to transition into Shlomo HaMelech into the building of Bayit Rishon. But Sefer Shmuel Bet ends off, and the life of David is wrapped up with the following episode, to be described, by the way, in greater detail and more astonishing colors, I would say, in Divrei HaYamim, when it's repeated a second time. There, it's what I will describe. Some details come out there. If you look at it later on in Sefer Shmuel Bet, you may not see it. You'll find it in Divrei HaYamim. What it happens is, as Divrei HaYamim describes, the Satan comes to David HaMelech and gets him, pushes him to count Klal Yisrael. To take a census. To count Klal Yisrael. He sends a crew, a team, a counting team throughout all of Eretz Yisrael to count the Jews, which we know you're not supposed to do. How do we know we're not supposed to do that?
That's right.
From Parshat? The question of Torah? Shkalim, which is the opening for Parshat Kiti, signs that for Shemot, get there in a couple of months. You're not allowed to count Jews. And you're not allowed to count them. If there will be, there'll be a plague. Rashi Yering brings that down there. In fact, there was a plague this episode. David counts them. After the counting comes back to him, the Navi comes to David and says, David, you sinned. You're not supposed to count the Jews. And David says, that's correct. You're right. I did a mistake. So the Navi gives him 3 options of punishment to choose from. And David chooses a short yet very painful, and that is a plague that runs around all of Eretz Yisrael, 70,000, if I remember correctly. 70,000 Jews die in this plague around Eretz Yisrael as a result of this count. It's the coming true of the terrible promise. It's very mysterious. What's wrong with counting people directly, and why does it bring about death, which it clearly did in this episode? We'll talk about it later on, Bezat Hashem. But in any case, the Malach HaMashchit on the third day, this Malach, which is running around Eretz Yisrael, killing people, is about to come over Yerushalayim with a sword spread out over the city. And at that moment, David and his entourage leave the palace and start going in Yerushalayim, around Yerushalayim. And when he sees Malach HaMashchit about to destroy the city and for the plague to hit the Yerushalayim city, David jumps to the ground and pleads HaKadosh Baruch Hu for forgiveness, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts that tefillah, that request, and he tells the Malach to stop, and the plague stops. And David says, if this is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered my prayers, this place where I hit the ground and pleaded, this is obviously the unknown place. Now I do know, this is the site of Beit HaMikdash, which in the Chumash, in Sefer Devarim, where it's described, and the only time in Chumash that there actually will be such a place in Eretz Yisrael, Beit HaMikdash, in Parshat Re'eh, it's referred to not as a Beit HaMikdash and not as Yerushalayim. All that it says there is, anybody know? Hamakom? Asher Yivchal, very good. So the place that I will choose, similar, by the way, to the... What?
Excellent.
Excellent. Very good. Excellent. Just like by a faith of Yitzchak, that mountain is told, Al achad ha'arim asher omar elecha, one of the mountains that I will show you, but when you get there, you'll see. Or one of the lands that I will show you earlier on, Lech Lecha, so too, The place that I will choose and that remains unknown. Why? What's the deeper meaning of it? We'll talk about it later on in the year of B'zot Hashem. But it has to remain as such. And when does it get to be revealed? David HaMelech in this episode. There's a lot that goes on over here, and there's a lot to think about. Why does the finding of the site of Beit HaMikdash have to come as a result of a mistake of counting Jews with a terrible plague, with a tshuva for that, and the responding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that gives birth to the knowing of the site of Beit HaMikdash? Sefer Shmuel Bet can come to a close. David HaMelech's life is basically wrapped up. We can go then, transition into Sefer Melachim Aleph. Shlomo HaMelech's life, Bayit Rishon, can be built as a result. Why does it have to come through that? What's so significant about counting? Or how you count in Parshat Shkalim? We'll talk about it when we get there, B'zot Hashem. But to the extent that we can understand the Chalam. But that's the scene of... Oh, sorry, so I didn't finish the bottom line, which is what's no get to us, and that is that David HaMelech then says, this is the place of the site of Beit HaMikdash. I have to make sure that it's ours. It really belongs to Goy by the name of Arvana HaYivusi. Arvana HaYivusi. By the way, the Zohar points out, Arvana HaYivusi, from Yivus, that was one of the Canaanite people that was actually in control of Yerushalayim. The Zohar points out, only the Zohar can do something like that, and that is that the hint, the fact that this is the place of the Aron is even hinted in the name of Arvana, over here. But in any case, he goes and David insists, same type of dialogue over there. David says, no, I'm going to buy it from you. And he buys it from him, and that's the acquisition of Yerushalayim. So we have Avram in the buying of Hebron, David in the buying of Yerushalayim. Who buys Shechem? What? So Yaakov Avinu. When he comes back from Laban, Parshat Vayishlach, he buys the city of Shechem. Now, stop by the way, geographically speaking, Shechem, Yerushalayim, Hebron, these three prime cities is somehow that have to be acquired. The rest of the Eretz Yisrael, no, these three cities have to be bought. What do they share in common, geographically speaking? For those of you familiar with the map of Eretz Yisrael. What? It's true, but be more specific. What? What's that? What? Yeah, that's what was said. True.
Oh, sorry.
No, you said it. Chazara is good. Yeah. No? You should try more. No? The map of Eretz Yisrael looks like this. Okay? This is the Kinneret, Tzfat, some of you were there, or some of us were there for Shabbat.
They're all in line with each other.
What?
They're all in line with each other.
That's correct. Not just not stand in line. That's the way I see it, at least. It's very bolet, it very stands out. It's the center line of Eretz Yisrael. With a northern piece, central piece, and a southern piece. Now, these three cities are not stam significant cities on one straight line of Eretz Yisrael, like the Amud HaShidra of Eretz Yisrael. Gosh, that's what I think it is. It's like the spine of Eretz Yisrael goes through these three cities. But Hebron is the capital of, is the Ira Bira of, what Shevet? Later on, for Kal Yisrael. For Yehuda. Which is where David HaMelech, king, starting from Yehuda, starts his kingdom for 7 years, and only then moves to Yerushalayim for another 33 years, putting together 40 years of kingdom. Shechem is the capital of Ephraim, or if you wish, of Yosef. And Yerushalayim? Very good. As Dov said, split between Yerushalayim and between Yehuda and Binyamin, or if you wish, Bnei Rachel and Bnei Leah, the descendants of Rachel and the descendants of Leah, Yir Shechubra LaYachdav, Sheba Lushi Teika, we'll talk about it a lot later on in Sefer Bereshit, that's where the Shvatim unify, Yosef and Yehuda, we know how significant and how intense is the relationship between these two, this is the capital of one, this is the capital of the other, and this is the meeting point in the middle, Binyamin being the extension, by the way, of Yosef, as he always is. Yosef had Tzadik, Binyamin had Tzadik. We'll talk about it later on. But in any case, these three cities, Shechem, Yerushalayim, and Hebron, they have to be bought, somehow creating the spine of Eretz Yisrael. Now, this, we have to take it further stages, and that is to define what these cities, or what these essences, the Mahuyot of the cities are about. What is Yerushalayim about? What's the city of Hebron? What's the city of Shechem? So Shechem we haven't gotten to yet. We mentioned Shechem once. By the way, when? I'll be 1 second. This past week's Parsha. Avraham just comes through Shechem into Eretz Yisrael, and then he's going to start traveling down south. But nothing more is mentioned. Shechem will be mentioned a lot later on, soon. We'll talk about it. Let's put Shechem on the side. Let's not attempt to define anything. How would you, though, define, even on any level, what Yerushalayim is about as opposed to Hebron? Or what is Hebron in contrast to Yerushalayim? What's the essence of, what's the mahut, it's the content of the city of Yerushalayim as opposed to the city of Hebron, in terms of Eretz Yisrael?
Origin of the people versus the people themselves.
What do you mean?
Meaning Chevron is where we Bnei Yisrael stems from.
Like here, Ha'avot, as opposed to where Klal Yisrael actually becomes.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way to look at it. I didn't think about it as such so much. I thought about some kind of an opposite direction, but doesn't necessarily contradict. I have to think about that. And that is. Yes, Yaakov.
Is it everything to do with the elements? I think there's a term also in the first time.
Well, Shechem does not, but it's Tzfat and Sderi.
No, right, that's why I think.
Yeah, right.
Is there anything to do
with that? I think there's different approaches, whether this is Adama and fire, or vice versa. But,
Avram
lived in Yerushalayim? Does that Kedah in Yerushalayim? At some level, I don't have to examine what Avi said before or more, but Yerushalayim is the city, there's many sources that bring it out. Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim is the city from where life comes into the world, or life comes clearly into Klal Yisrael. Beit HaMikdash is the spring of life for Klal Yisrael. Kisham Sira Hashem et Habracha, Chaim Ad HaOlam. It's an example from one of the Shir HaMa'alot, in Tehillim, in the Kuf Lamed. But in any case, it's the city of life, the city of post-life. Beyond life, the opening to Gan Eden, as sources talk about, in terms of Hebron, the burial place of Eretz Yisrael, the post-life site in Eretz Yisrael, that is Hebron. Place of life in itself, coming out of the world is Yerushalayim.